Welcome back. This is Sheets Stuff You Should Know. I'm Dr. Rosie Bush here at UC Davis, and I'm joined today with my co-host, Dan Makin. Where are you, Dan?
Good morning. I am in the spare office in the Placer, Nevada Cooperative Extension office up here in Auburn. I've got
it looks like a supply closet.
Yeah, it pretty much is. It's also, it doubles as a recording studio too.
Perfect. Yes.
How are you?
I'm good. I'm tired. It's been a busy week and it's Thursday, so I guess that means we're nearing the end, but
busy week and a short week, but it's been that way here too.
Yeah.
You had a webinar last night?
I had a webinar last night. Carolyn Hyde from, she's the sheep and goat extension specialist for Wisconsin and Iowa. So she's putting on a webinar series, and I got to do one on neonatal care, the first 24 hours. And
cool.
Yeah, it was good.
Very cool.
Yep. It's very timely, I think.
Yeah, no kidding. That's cool.
Yeah. Well, you had a workshop last night. What were you doing?
Yeah, we had a workshop in partnership with a nonprofit up here called Sierra Harvest. And we did a workshop on grant writing for farmers. There's a farm to school grant program through our State Department of Agriculture just opened up. And so we gave people some grant writing tips, and I got to play like I was an ag economist for 15 minutes or so. And so it was good. It was good, cool. But made for a very long day.
I bet. Very. Yeah. Yeah. Because I saw you yesterday, which was great.
I know. I know. And I got a report back. So we're at the tail end of lambing. I think I've got one ewe left to lamb, but the ewe that you've been helping me with that had the retained placenta is a ewe. She's probably 11 years old, and she's probably got the greatest maternal instincts of any ewe I've ever seen. I mean, you almost don't want to pick up her lambs if she's not behind a fence.
Yeah.
And I thought maybe she'd mellowed.
No.
This morning I treated her, and then I marked her lamb, and she growled at me and, you know, kind of head pressed and tried to knock me over. Finally got done marking her lamb and let the lamb go. And the ewe walked right between my legs, and she's just tall enough that I can't keep my feet on the ground, and knocked me right on my butt.
Oh my goodness.
And took her lamb and said, "See you, buddy."
at least she's feeling great.
That's
herself.
Right. She's definitely feeling back to her old self. So that's somewhere awesome. There is a video when Kalea Schiller did her maternal research, there is a video of that you actually in slow motion headbutting me, knocking me over, stepping on my chest, and then taking her lambs and disappearing. Wow.
So it's that you.
It's that you. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh man.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wonder hopefully her
ewe lamb inherited half of that maternal instinct.
Yeah. Right? Did she, so she had twins or a single?
She had twins. One didn't make it. I don't know if it was a hard birth. I wasn't there when they were born. And it was, we've had a lot of wet weather, so could have been weather related, but, and I mean, she's 11 years old. It could have just been being 11 years old. So,
yeah. So that's interesting. Cause I think of retained placentas being either we have a little bit of a nutritional problem with like low calcium, or if they have dystocias or difficult deliveries, that can make them more prone to retained placentas. So that would fit with what you think could have happened with that lamb.
Yeah, I think that is what happened. The lamb that didn't make it was pretty meconium stained too, which makes me think it just took a long time.
Yeah.
So
interesting.
But
glad she's feeling better.
She's very glad I don't have to try to catch her again.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. So yesterday we were at the center. The vet school has an internal grant program that's funded by USDA hatch funds and some other, like the dairy industry has specific funds for grants for them. So they actually feed through this funding program. It's called the Center for Food Animal Health. Which is neat because then we can compete internally for small pots of funds that really helps us get, pilot studies done, preliminary data, so that we can apply for bigger grants that are kind of competitive nationally, which can be more challenging to get. So that's why the morning was a lot of dairy because there's a little bit more funding for them, but just a little. What did you think, though? I think those days are really interesting, but it's,
I did too. I think a lot of it is well beyond my mental capacity to comprehend. But one of the things I find interesting, particularly in those topics where I don't have a lot of personal knowledge, is comparing presentation styles. And there were some presentations that, even though it was a topic well beyond my comprehension, I got it. And then there were some presentations that were just
Yeah, I
whoa.
had moments like that too.
Oh,
I
good. You know what? So I'm gonna brag on you just a little bit. One of the really cool things was that one of the projects you reported on kind of grew out of the podcast, which
Yeah.
that's really cool. And I who somebody oh somebody last night at the web at the seminar at the workshop came up and said, "I didn't realize you were a podcaster. I just discovered Sheep Stuff You Should Know." And it was the same thing. He said, "Some of that stuff's way over my head, but some of it's I'm like, oh, now I get it." So
Yeah.
that was kind of cool feedback.
Yeah. And I do, I think that's why the podcast is so valuable to me because you guys ask such great questions. And I think that's true extension, right? It's like we're t having conversations and talking about things that we don't know. And then it's like, well, let's figure it out. So that's
Absolutely. And
cool.
that's part of the cool thing about getting feedback from folks who listen too, because it makes us think more deeply about some of the topics we've discussed and ask more questions. So,
Yeah,
yeah.
definitely. Well, today we were going to talk about predator interactions and then predator mortalities, and we could go. I don't have a list of questions, so I figured we'd just talk about it. But
It's a light topic, you know. People love to talk about the predators and death loss.
totally. I've been doing a bunch of necropsy workshops, not a bunch, but they've been trickling in, and I recently did one 2 weeks ago, and we made like a one pager that we could laminate on what are the materials they would need, the photos they'd need to take, and then what tissues they should collect to submit. And it's more of like a photographic guide so that because those are all listed and detailed with other resources that I tend to include for those workshops. But the photographic guide is kind of a just in time, you can have it with your necropsy kit kind of a thing. And we translated that into Spanish for the employees of the operation we were working with, which was really cool.
Very cool.
And I'd like to have, I think this predator fact sheet that you guys created is so incredible and helpful, and it would be really neat to get this translated into Spanish too. That would be neat.
I think it would. I think that's something we should work on. And kind of as a preface to this conversation, had a conversation last week, which is pretty typical here in the foothills. Had lunch with the county trapper, and he was going out to a sheep operation, where they were absolutely certain that they'd had a mountain lion come in and kill some ewes. And the trapper skinned the ewes out and found the bite marks and the location of the bites, and it was very obviously coyotes. But it's pretty common here in the foothills that anytime something's dead, you jump to the conclusion that it's a mountain lion. And I'm not sure why that is. It's
Yeah,
maybe
that's
because it's more fun to
interesting.
talk about in the coffee shop.
Yeah.
I think part of what I've learned over the years is how important it is to know what predator you're dealing with.
Yeah. And why? Like, so that's what I think is really interesting. Like, why? Like, one, it's important to tell the difference between bite marks that made to kill versus
Right.
carcasses that are being fed off of
Being
after
scattered.
they
Yeah,
died.
exactly. So
And
how would you
like,
tell that, Rosie? How would you tell if it was scavenged versus a lethal attack?
well, I think mostly the blood. So if it was a bite mark that caused the death, you would see evidence of hemorrhage. So like clotted blood, bruising,
Right.
things like that. If it was after the fact, then you would see like tissue disruption, or like you would see bite marks, but not necessarily the bruising or clotting around
Right.
it.
Right. Right. And I think that's the other thing I've learned over the years is that everything we think of as a predator is also a scavenger. So, knowing what to look for in terms of what killed an animal is pretty important too, because you'll have coyotes, even mountain lions will come in and scavenge on a carcass. And
It's free food. I mean, no one's
yeah,
going to turn down free food.
exactly. And that's part of the challenge with wolves now in California is finding the kills in a timely manner before something else has scavenged on them. I don't know if you saw this, but we just had our first Cal Fish and Wildlife confirmed wolf kill on sheep in January.
I did
And
not see that.
there's been other sheep mortality, but this is the first time they've actually confirmed that these sheep were killed by wolves. It was up in Plumas County.
How many sheep did
Think
they
it was
lose? Do you
three or
know?
four ewes.
Okay.
Have to go back and look. And of course, now our compensation program is out of money. And so basically, all you get with a confirmation is, gee, we're sorry. But it's, I think that's another piece of understanding what's causing mortality too. And this is probably somewhat unique to California, but we have wolves are a state listed species. It is actually illegal to harm or harass a gray wolf in California. Mountain lions have legal protection, and so knowing what we can and can't do in terms of mitigating or taking care of a problem individual predator are more limited here than they may be in other Western states. So.
And so what are some of the differences between, so the main predators that we have here are, oh gosh, there's so many, but I feel like coyotes are the most prominent that I think of. And then there's obviously domestic dogs are always a problem, but I think that really depends on where you're grazing. And as we do more of this kind of urban interface grazing, that becomes more of a problem. And then you mentioned mountain lions. Bears, I've heard of people talking about, but they, so from what I have heard, it sounds like they're more of a problem with getting into the supplements and like dog food and all of that. But I
Yeah,
imagine they can also, yeah.
that's been we've had I know we've had black bears around our sheep and have not had any predator losses to them. And there's probably a number of reasons for that. The guard dog work that I've been doing up in the high country on Forest Service ground, we get lots of bears in our trail cameras up there. And that operation's never lost anything. Of course, it's all dry ewes, so it's bigger sheep, but they've never lost anything during the 5 or 6 years we've been studying their guard dogs up there. So we don't have grizzlies, which is okay with me. You've heard the story in Yellowstone about the bear warnings that they have up.
No.
So they have signs up that say we have both grizzlies and black bears here, and you should carry pepper spray and wear bells on your hiking boots. And if you come on bear scat in the trail that has berries and stuff like that in it, it was a black bear. And if it smells like pepper and has bells in it, that was a grizzly.
Like, good luck. I hope you have your running shoes on. Oh my gosh.
So, you know, we have gray and red foxes in the foothills. Gray foxes are pretty small. We actually last year fenced a gray fox into one of our lambing paddocks.
Yeah, I remember that picture. He's just sitting there, sunning.
And I'm sure either the dogs chased it off or something, but red foxes will take a lamb. Bobcats will take a lamb. I know some folks up on the North Coast who've had bald and golden eagles take
I was gonna
lambs.
say birds of prey are pretty.
Yeah.
Yeah. The
Yeah.
golden eagles here are so big, I could definitely see them taking one off.
Yeah. Yeah. I've talked to some producers over on the North Coast that have had lots of problems with ravens, particularly
Yeah.
where a pasture lambing situation coming in when a lamb's being
I
born.
remember Ryan mentioning that too, even down in the Montezuma Hills.
Yeah, right.
Saying that, yeah, they'll just kind of stalk them while they're lambing, and even before they're born, they'll go after them, like when they're
Yeah.
being delivered.
Yeah, which is gruesome.
Yeah.
So
So,
one of the interesting things that I am learning about with regards to predators, well, first of all, I guess knowing what predators you have around is important, because the tool, there's a few twists on the tools that we have available to us depending on the predator. You know, with gray wolves, we're learning about that from producers in the Rockies and other parts of the West that have been dealing with wolves for quite a while. And I think we still have a lot to learn. But I think part of it is how each of those predators hunt too. You know, canine predators are kind of what we call coursing predators, and so they're going to chase animals to make a kill, whereas mountain lions are more ambush predators. I think I'd rather be ambushed than chased,
Yeah.
but you know, that knowing kind of what habitat you're working in is probably part of that equation too, what to watch for.
Do you think those types of attacks, because we talk a lot about indirect effects of predation, do you think that the different types of predators could have different indirect impacts? Because, like you said, an ambush you kind of don't see coming. They probably happen few and far between
Yeah.
versus being stalked and chased.
I think it would be interesting to look at that. Intuitively, it would seem like the coursing predators, wolves in particular, are more likely to have those indirect impacts. And there's been some work up in Oregon kind of looking at, in particular with cattle, what their responses are to other canines if they've been exposed to wolves versus naive to wolves. And there's been some work that shows lower weight gains and reproductive losses and some of those types of things. I talked to a producer up in northeastern California about a year ago who had, I think she'd lost, I don't know, 18 or 19 ewes, most of which were hit by a truck on the highway. They were chased through fences onto the highway. But their trapper came out and found evidence of wolves. And the trucker that hit the sheep actually saw a wolf. And she indicated that the ewes that did survive, she had about a 50% abortion loss in the lambs they were carrying. So just the stress. What are some other things that stress might do indirectly like that?
Well, stress, and there's something called capture myopathy, where if they're chased, excuse me. Sorry. It's first thing in the morning, man.
After a long day.
Yeah. If so, when these guys are chased, and we see it especially with domestic dog attacks too, or I guess that's most of my experiences with domestic dog attacks, is they're mu it's kind of like an endurance runner where their muscles kind of break down, and you get the pigment in the muscles called myoglobin that actually goes into the bloodstream, and it can injure their kidneys. And so you'll see brown urine and things like that. And so that kidney damage could also be just kind of like a physiological reason for some of the sequelae or like the outcomes that we see after some of these attacks. And, not just, I mean, stress for sure, but sheep, because their pregnancies are maintained mostly by the fetus, they're a little bit less susceptible to stress-causing abortions. Whereas
Okay.
goats, when they are stressed because they're CL dependent, if the dam is stressed, they're more likely to have an abortion.
Interesting. I didn't realize that difference.
Yeah, but there is a physiological reason for abortions in sheep, after an event like that. Yeah, but that might be why we see more abortions in cattle and goats from predation than we would in sheep. And it doesn't mean they're not stressed. It's just we're less likely to see that impact.
It manifests itself differently. Interesting.
Yeah, like,
I go ahead. Go
oh, I
ahead.
was going to say wool breaks and things like that are big things. You certainly see suppressed immune function with a lot of chronic stress. Which was interesting. We were talking with someone a couple years ago, and they were talking about the amount of clostridial infections that they were seeing that they had never seen before. And, it's interesting that if you have animals that are now being predated that weren't before, that even the way they manifest disease has shifted with this new kind of influx of predators.
And I think the other, this is a data point of one, so it's not scientific by any stretch, but the first time that we lost sheep to a coyote before we had guard dogs, I actually found the sheep that had been killed by observing the sheep that were not killed and how vigilant they were. I mean, their heads were up, their ears were forward, they were looking at a particular place in this field, probably 12 hours after the attack happened. And I think that increased vigilance probably has some stress effects, but certainly if their heads are up, they're not eaten, and that can, over the long term, can have some real significant impacts too.
Yeah, definitely. That kind of, I think, well, I've had this question in my head. I didn't know how to ask it. But how would you tell if there wasn't a, like, if you didn't have, if you weren't there, didn't see the predator, and don't have evidence of a carcass, would there be a way to tell that there was an attack other than decreased numbers? If you're
Oh,
really good with your counting sheep abilities.
I mean, particularly if you had a big flock of sheep, it'd be hard to tell until you count it. And that's one of the points we've made in some of the compensation programs, is that a lot of times in big operations, you're not going to realize a loss until you count sheep onto a truck. And so it may be, if they're in the high country for 2.5 months, that attack could have happened 75 days ago, and you'll never find any evidence of a dead animal at that point. But one of the things that I've noted with our sheep in particular is vigilance. But fence being down, if sheep are run through a fence, that generally doesn't happen on its own. We've had, I don't have any confirmation of this. I think in all of the years we've had sheep in the foothills, I've lost one ewe to a mountain lion. And the reason I think that is that one night in particular, the guard dog was out of a pretty secure paddock, and the dog was really upset, and we never found this ewe. I didn't know she was gone until a couple of weeks later, but we never found any kind of carcass or anything, which is kind of indicative of a mountain lion attack. They'll either drag the carcass off, or they'll hide it under the brush and duff, to come back to it to protect it from scavengers. And so it kind of fits what I would expect to see with a mountain lion attack. That's one of the things that we've worked with producers to do, is to put trail cameras up and kind of understand where to place cameras so that they've got evidence of what's around too. And I think that's a good tool to use, if you're
How
curious.
many cameras is it, like, on a sheep number basis or acre, or how would you decide?
You know, from a practical standpoint, from a research basis, we put cameras out on kind of a 1 kilometer grid. So no camera is within a kilometer of another camera, typically. I think, you know, if you're doing this just because you want to know what's around your place, most of us are familiar with what the game trails look like, and they're probably pretty similar to the sheep trails in lots of ways. Animals like to use the path of least resistance. So placing them on those game trails is a good technique. I've actually, in the high country, have placed trail cameras on an animal that died from pneumonia just to see what scavengers were coming in. And that was pretty informative too, to kind of see the interactions between predators and guard dogs and all of that in a scavenging situation. Just got back from the Society for Range Management conference, and there was a great talk about some new technology, AI technology with game cameras that have cell phone capacity. And there are onboard AI programs on some of the cameras now that if they detect something in the frame, they'll send you an email. And there's now a machine learning system that they're just trying out that actually identify predators. And so you'll get an email that says, camera number 3, appeared to be a mountain lion 2 minutes ago. So it gives you some real time, if you have cell service, gives you some real time information about what's going on too. I think some of those things will be helpful just to kind of identify more localized threats and be able to respond more quickly.
I know Andrew Hess at UNR is working on some, I don't know if it's machine learning, but they have a bunch of those GPS collars, and they're looking at flocking behavior. And I wonder if there's probably signals that could be sent based on, you know, bunching or running.
There's been some work with that with cattle, with GPS collars that have accelerometers on them. Mm-hmm. So you can tell how fast the animals are moving.
Right.
And that's been, I think there's some technology like that. Well, virtual fence technology can mm-hmm. provide some of that too. And I think kind of a side benefit of looking at that technology longer term as well. I was in the resource management meeting at ASI in Denver last month, and it's a classic rancher comment, but Wildlife Services is there and always give a great report, kind of what they're working on, and they're mm-hmm. they're doing a lot of work on non-lethal tools, which I think is great. And the presenter said, you know, we're working on all these things, but once again, there's no silver bullet that works in every situation. And a rancher in the back grumbled, yeah, but a silver bullet will work in every situation. One of the questions I've got is how is lethal control related to non-lethal control? Does the lack of lethal control options make our non-lethal tools less effective, just because there's not that fear of human contact in the predator population that there might have been? And I think that's an area that would be interesting to research further.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I mean, we can get permits for predators that are repeat offenders, right? But you have to be able to prove that, and I don't know how easy that is to do.
They've just changed that policy on mountain lions in California, where it's a 3 strikes. You have to mm-hmm. implement, after the first 2 attacks, you have to implement some kind of new non-lethal tool. Mm-hmm. And if the attack continues and you can prove it's the same animal, then after the third attack, you can get a depredation permit. Mm-hmm. In practice, from the folks I've talked to, biologists and trappers, it's really rare to get a depredation permit for a lion anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's California's an interesting place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Lots of
that does seem like an interesting question. Is I think we're very invested and committed to trying everything as far as, making the dogs work and all of the other tools that we have. But at what point do they learn that none of these work? Because I know, and it seems like wolves are very smart, but I've also heard the flip side that the lethal control on wolves is can also cause problems with increased litter size and increased, yeah, that's really interesting, that dynamic. Like how do we then, if they're really quick to learn how to get around our non-lethal control, how, what's the best way to really get them out of the situation in it?
And the coyotes kind of have the same response to indiscriminate lethal control based on the research I've looked at. I think there's our sheep friends will I'm sure love this idea, but I've kind of come to the conclusion. I know we've got coyotes around and close to our sheep from trail cameras and scat and just hearing them this time of year at night. I almost think in my situation, if I have a coyote in my environment that doesn't like to eat lamb or mutton, that coyote should stay because it's filling a niche that might be filled. If it were gone, it might be filled by a coyote that doesn't understand it's not supposed to eat my sheep. So I think there's almost this kind of ecological approach to coexisting with predators. That has some benefit too. I think there's a lot we don't understand about it. And we
And
don't
it
understand how that may flip. A coyote may all of a sudden there's nothing, no natural prey to eat, and here's a lamb. But
Yeah, that was going to be my question, is does it Is there seasonality to it when there are more natural prey? Is there a way to, approach increasing that kind of biodiversity so that there are more natural prey for these animals that aren't going away anytime soon?
I think there is. I think that's a lot of the operations that go to this High Sierra here now are taking dry ewes. They're fall lambing. They'll wean the lambs in the spring, and then the ewes go to the high country kind of for the breeding season. And I think that is also a time period when there's lots of natural prey in the high country. And so the conflict is minimized. Not saying it doesn't exist, but the conflict is really minimized. I think if you were spring lambing and taking pairs to the mountains, that there'd be more conflict. And so that it's what I find so fascinating about it, Rosie, is that it's a biological system. It's not a mechanical system that you can engineer your way out of. You have to really understand production cycles and animal behavior, sheep behavior, predator behavior, all those things.
Yeah, that was one of the things that I questioned when we were on that project in Blodgett is, they naturally want to bed at the top of the hill because of their instinct to be able to keep from being ambushed, basically, and be able to see around them while they're bedded down. And I wondered if we weren't allowing them to do that natural behavior, even if there isn't a predator around, does that then induce indirect stress because we're kind of inhibiting that natural instinct? And I don't know, there's so many questions I have about their natural behavior and what they would want to do in these situations and how we can best accommodate that and, in the system.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think both of us have seen animals follow guard dogs to places where the sheep or the goats are uncertain about where they're going, and they get some level of confidence from the dog. There was some work done up at Dubois looking at that suggested sheep with a dog were able to use 20 to 25% more of a particular rangeland pasture because they had more confidence to go further out from their bed grounds. I've
Yeah,
watched
that's
this. It's
interesting.
fun up there in the mountains to see the guard dogs lead the sheep out in the morning and lead the sheep back to camp in the midday when they go back to ruminate. And There's some really interesting dynamics around that, I think, too.
Yeah, that's cool. Especially with feeders, it seems like
Yes.
they're like, okay, that's our adopted mom. We will follow him everywhere.
Yes. 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 I always like watching the lambs crawl over the dog, too, and the dog just going, oh my God, I can't believe you're doing this again.
They love it. So if you were to go out and someone says, oh, it was definitely a mountain lion, are there, other than bite marks, like are there really quick ways to tell, okay, this is or was not a mountain lion, or are there attacks that are more similar that you have to do a little bit more kind of investigation to figure out who was the predator in that situation, or?
Yeah, my understanding is that coyotes tend to eat the guts first and the muscles secondarily. They're going after softer tissues, whereas a mountain lion is almost surgical. They don't drag the guts out. They'll eat the larger muscles. They might eat the heart. So looking kind of if it's been torn apart, dog attacks are really easy to tell because dogs don't know what the
They
hell they're
don't eat
doing, and
anything.
they're just gruesome. I've was taught by one of our wildlife services guides just to skin an animal back under the throat and then behind the ears over the top of the neck as a way to get a really quick look at where the bite, where the hemorrhaging is, and the distance between the canine teeth bite marks is a really good indication. I've got trying to build a predator skull collection just so people can kind of see the difference in tooth size and bite dimension and that sort of thing. And it's startling how much bigger a mountain lion's mouth is than a coyote's mouth. Really, really clear. I think that's a pretty good technique if you can just to it, with a sharp knife, it takes a couple of minutes to skin that much back and just see what you find. And then I think I haven't looked at the evidence on this wolf attack that was confirmed, but my understanding with wolves is that you'll see a lot of bite marks on the flank and on the haunch. They'll hamstring an animal to bring it down. So the not only are the bites bigger than a coyote, but there are more bites in the back half of the animal to look at.
If there are animals that have survived an attack, do you know if there's a difference between like a wild predator and a domestic dog? I know I've, like I said, I have most of my experience with domestic dogs, and I know that those wounds get a whole lot worse before they get better because of the shaking that dogs do when they attack.
Yeah.
And so a lot of the damage is actually underneath the skin. You see puncture wounds, but
Yeah.
not a lot of like long lacerations. Is that different for wild predator attacks, or is it similar?
My understanding is that it's similar. If you go through the depredation reports from Fish and Wildlife here on wolves, there's a lot of mention of animals that were injured that had to be euthanized because of their injuries. And it may not be the shaking and the kind of tissue trauma, but certainly infected wounds and those types of things are pretty common, I think,
Yeah, I
too.
would imagine if a wolf punctures through the belly, then you've got
Yeah.
immediate infection in the belly. And then
Yeah.
I've seen coyotes that will puncture through the airway and the throat, and even though
Yeah.
they're alive, they can't breathe well.
Yeah. 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 And I think after an attack, observing what's going on with the animals that survived the attack is a crucial part of that too.
Yeah, I think that's what makes it so hard. It's, especially, I think most folks could understand a predator, with that whole interaction of natural prey, the domestic livestock being there. If a predator takes one, cleanly kills it, All right, that still is not ideal, and hopefully we can figure out a way to manage that out of this system. But when they just kill a num you know, a bunch of them and leave them there, that's what's really frustrating.
Yeah, it is. It is. And I think the other part that's kind of hard for us as producers to articulate, our product has to die in order for us to sell the product, right? The endpoint for our lambs is at a processing plant, is in a package of meat. And I think to the outside, it's hard to understand the difference between raising an animal that you know has to die and then being upset about an animal that's killed by a predator in its natural environment. I go back, I have a friend in southeastern Oregon. I'm going to name her on the podcast. I don't know if she listens, but Liz Hubbard is a friend that raises some good dogs. They have sheep and cows. And I was upset one day about a lamb I couldn't save. And Liz's comment was, "The day that that doesn't bother us is the day we should sell the sheep, because the sheep are dependent on us. They are domesticated, and so they are dependent on us for feed, water, shelter, and protection. And shepherds take that responsibility very, very seriously." And I think it's hard to articulate kind of the sense of loss when you've lost animals to a predator. It's part of the business, but it's also in some ways reflects, at least for me, reflects of my own failure that I wasn't able to figure out how to protect the animals from the predators.
Right. Yeah. And I think we all re you know, we understand we're in a biological system. It's an, you know, there we interface with predators and wildlife on a daily basis. It's not that we don't want them there. It's these types of situations that are really frustrating because it is not, you know, I think that's probably where a lot of folks think, oh, well, they need to eat too. Okay, but these are not just them filling their bellies. They are doing this for fun in some cases, and that is not okay because, like you said, it is our responsibility to protect these animals. And it's, yeah. So, and I think that comes to like why it's so important to learn what type of predator is here so that you can be more strategic in your measures to try to protect. And it is interesting. It does seem to come down to, you know, having people present and, you know, able to kind of be able to respond and manipulate a situation, but that gets harder and harder.
I think the other piece of it, and I've talked to lots of other producers that feel this way. You know, one of the reasons I like having sheep on rangeland is that I get to be out in that environment in all seasons, all kinds of weather, day and night. You see some amazing things from a wildlife perspective. I mean, it's up there in Truckee, I've come upon a sow bear and a couple of cubs that were up a tree before I even knew they were there. Just amazing to see animals like that in their habitat. I've seen two mountain lions. I know more mountain lions have seen me over, but I've seen two in my lifetime. And there's something pretty cool about seeing those big animals in their habitat, as long as they're not eating sheep, right?
Yeah, I remember one of the herders was like, "I really want to see a bear." We're like, "Oh, okay."
I would love to be honest. I would too. I think
Yeah.
that's part of it. So I have one other question that's occurred to me, and I'm curious as to your take on this. So how do our lambs learn what to eat?
I think a couple of ways. One, I think by copying the, either their mother or their buddies. And then I think trial and error is a part of it too. They're curious. So they'll kind of, you know, like any young animal or baby will put anything in its mouth. So they eat things they shouldn't. But.
How do you think carnivores learn to eat, learn their food preferences in the same way.
I imagine their mother teaches them how to hunt and, yeah, shows them where to go.
One of the questions I really am interested in is how that those preferences are formed, and if there are predators in the environment that are more likely to see domestic livestock as a food source, is that create a genetic predisposition in those predator populations? I'm really curious about that.
Yeah, that would be interesting.
I don't want to be the control group. That's the hard thing about research on this, right?
Yeah.
Why don't you test whether guard dogs work? We're going to make you in the group without guard dogs, okay? Tell us how many sheep you lose.
Yep.
No, thank you.
No, thanks.
No, thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, it is interesting because you'll hear people say, oh, well, that, you know, we know all that stuff. And it's like, well, but, you know, like you may know it from generational knowledge or learning from a mentor, which is really important. But it's also important for these kind of policy decisions and new coming first generation farmers and ranchers to be able to have access to that type of information too.
That policy arena, I think, is really critical. And I think that's an area where extension can and should be helpful too, because there's all of this kind of experiential knowledge, people that have been out on the landscape all times of day and night, all seasons, and seen some of this, but it's not data that was collected by a scientist, right?
And right.
I think one of our jobs in extension is to help document and validate those on the ground observations, so that they become part of those policy discussions. I think that's really critical, really important.
Yeah, definitely. So I think we can link this fact sheet to the show notes. I'll figure out. I think we can do that.
I think we can too.
Cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then, but this was developed by you guys in Cooperative Extension and then the California Fish and Wildlife. So if you're in California, who would they reach out to if they wanted some help on figuring out predators in their area?
You know, Wildlife Services is great. Most counties have a Wildlife Services technician, a trapper, and those guys are wildlife experts. The guys here in California, mostly guys, are just a wealth of knowledge about predator behavior and habitat, and you know what you need to look for in livestock. California Department of Fish and Wildlife now has some human wildlife conflict folks that are willing to work on these types of things, and I think they can be helpful as well. So your local game warden would have access to those folks if you've got a question. Cooperative Extension in areas where there's range livestock, typically Cooperative Extension has some resources and information that can be helpful in that regard as well.
And Wildlife Services is a national program, right? USDA. So
yeah,
that should be available in all states.
Yeah, it is available in all states. There's been some legal and policy issues that have arisen in the last couple of years that I think we're kind of working through. But certainly in Northeastern California, where the wolves are, there's some outstanding Wildlife Services folks up there that are, you know, they live in the community. They can be there at a moment's notice if there's a problem. They're really responsive and really helpful. Yeah. What do you got going on the rest of the week, Dr. Bush?
I am working on a number of presentations, and I'm working on some vet CE for helping people learn how to age fetal pregnant or fetuses and goat pregnancies.
Oh,
And
cool.
this Saturday, I'm going up to Cohasset, which is in like near Paradise, and doing a goat ownership workshop with some folks up there. And then, yeah, so
Busy weekend. Cool.
Always something, yeah.
Yeah, very cool. Very cool.
Yep. Yep.
Hopefully the last ewe will give up her lambs this weekend and we'll be done with lambing. Well, I think she's going to wait till it's really bad weather again, but it's kind
Of
of the way
course.
it goes. And
The monsoon rains.
Exactly. Exactly. We
Sure,
have a,
you've gotten a lot of use out of your lamb raincoats this year.
I have. I have. My Shearwell lamb mechs are worth every cent of 40 cents a piece in weather like this. They've been great.
I did mention those in the webinar last night.
They are, well, there's some bigger producers starting to use them now too, I think, aren't there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. At least they have them on hand, and
Yeah.
so that they have, because that I think is what's so frustrating is when you know something exists and when you need it, it's too late.
Yeah,
So.
exactly. Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
We're doing a wildfire workshop, ranch hardening and fire tools and that kind of stuff on Saturday, which should be fun. Fire season will be here before we know it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh.
With all these rains, we'll probably have a good amount of brush ready to go,
Yeah,
unfortunately. But
lots of fine fuel and
yeah.
fine fuel. One person's fine fuel is another person's feed, right?
Yes. Well, we need more people to be feeding off of it. We'll be
Exactly.
okay.
Exactly.
More grazing. So cool.
Well, thank you. This was fun.
Yeah, thank you.
Let's see who takes us out. Do I take? Oh, you know what? May the Wonder Dog was present for our taping.
What was that?
She thought that the topic was really timely, and she can't wait to hear it on recording. I lost my speakers. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. It got a little blippy. I'll take us out.
You take us out.
Okay. This has been Sheep Stuff You Should Know. Thanks so much. We'll talk to you next time. Bye.